I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 16th of September. One of the nation's leading gun violence experts is our guest this hour, Dr. Stephen Hargarten. He has treated many Milwaukee area victims of firearm violence. He treated those who were shot at the Sikh Temple and were brought to the emergency department at Frederick Hospital. In the early 90s, he received a federal grant to establish the nation's first firearm injury center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's author of a 1997 book, Reducing Firearm Injury and Death, a public health source book on guns. It detailed who was getting killed by guns, how, why, and with what types of guns. His research has been defunded by the federal government for reasons we'll explore this hour. The doctor worries that lawmakers still have little to no public health data to inform their gun policy decision-making. Today's conversation, prompted by a study done by Urban Institute, it was released in August, which looked at where gun violence is clustered, who is at risk, and what the hospital cost is of injuries caused by intentional firearm assault. They looked at six different states. Dr. Hargarten asks, What I'm struggling with is this new social norm. This is what we're going to have to live with if we have more personal access to firearms. We have a public health issue to discuss. Do we wait for the next outbreak, or is there something that we can do to prevent it? He's professor and chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin and director of the Injury Research Center. He's associate dean of global health, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. The question of the hour, is there something we can do to prevent gun violence in this country? Dr. Hargarten, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Kathleen.
Yeah, you've been doing this for a long time, sir, haven't you?
Well, I guess it's unfortunate that many cities across the United States have been really experiencing what really came about in the early 90s, which was a significant upturn of firearm-related deaths and injuries across really virtually every metropolitan area in the United States. And many of us began to apply public health principles, a disease model, to try to better understand how we can best reduce this burden through identifying high-risk groups, identifying high-risk environments, just like we do with other public health diseases and burdens.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that the federal government has stopped funding programs like yours all over the country? I know you're continuing, but with other sources of funding. Did they think it was too political a topic, or what?
Well, I'm not sure if I agree with your summary there, Kathleen. What happened in the late 90s, result of some very challenging discussions and concerns, that there was a move in Congress to remove firearm-related programmatic activities from the CDC's injury center. And that was primarily, and in this case, we were supported to develop information systems to help better understand firearm-related deaths and injuries. And the policymakers were concerned that this research was being used to the researchers were using these monies to lobby Congress for policy change, which was not an accurate assessment. And what happened was is the monies were redirected towards traumatic brain injury. Interestingly enough, firearm injuries account for a significant portion of largely fatal head injuries in suicide and some homicide victims. So what was unfortunate was that that dampened interest in doing firearm-related programs, because there was such a delicate and I think a legitimate concern that while we do research, the research is informing policy, maybe or maybe not, but that the researchers are not using CDC funds to actively lobby for policies. And that, fine differentiation is of critical importance, so that there was no restriction on doing firearm-related research, Kathleen. It was that we're not permitted to use federal dollars to lobby for policies addressing firearm-related deaths and injuries. That critical difference got clouded, if you will, and thus there was no real objective research funding stream coming from CDC, and that became problematic for us, for many of us, in subsequent years to finding dollars that would support what many of us want to do, which is better understand this challenging and vexing public health issue.
So are you able to continue your research?
Well, I think that what's happened is, again, with the more recent tragedies that occurred at Sandy Hook and other mass shootings and the result of the Biden commission, that there was an objective effort to provide dollars to the injury research, to the injury center at CDC for firearm related research. That hasn't happened. But what has happened is that other federal agencies, such as the National Institutes of Health, National Institutes of Justice, have been forthcoming with firearm related research opportunities and calls for proposals. And we have been applying for those, and also private foundation venture fund supports are also coming to provide support for research proposals that are reviewed and thus funded. So we were a recent recipient of one of those grants.
Let's talk about this recent study done by the Urban Institute in which they looked at the kind of gun violence. Those mass shootings capture our attention for months and months, but there are shootings happening all the time in major cities in this country. And it was an interesting study looking at 2010 was the year. The total cost, including societal cost of firearm violence, estimated at $174 billion. And they looked at where the gun violence was concentrated. I guess you could say in most of these places, a small number of places and within a small set of communities. So they tend to be poor. They tend to be minority. They tend to be affecting young people. And I'm sure you've seen quite a bit of that from the Milwaukee area at Fratert.
Well, right. And I think this is the latest of several studies that have largely pretty much came with the same results, which is that firearm-related deaths and injuries are costly. They're costly to the community in direct and indirect costs, that they are, and I think this was of note, that the metropolitan areas that I mentioned earlier are disproportionately affected, and thus areas of cities are disproportionately affected, and that young black males are disproportionately affected. It's again, it's a striking result, and yet it's not been strikingly new. We have known this for many years.
Mm-hmm. And do we know what to do about it? Are we concentrating research in that area? Because obviously, it's if people survive these horrendous acts of violence, many of them have significant, I'm sure, health problems for their lifetimes.
Well, we know that there are adverse childhood events that 3-year-olds witnessing a shooting, 6-year-old witnessing violence in the home, 10-year-olds who are witnessing violence in the streets. I think these events do adversely affect their development and their subsequent risk for medical and injury problems as they grow into their adolescence and young adulthood. So we know that there are these predictable outcomes, all negative. We do not know as much about how to effectively interrupt that or how to effectively prevent that from happening. So those research dollars to help us figure this out are challenging to find, and it's very, very challenging to develop these programs to really fully understand what works, because there's not a one single intervention that's going to work. These are multiple, there are multiple interventions needing from all sectors of civil society to address these, from early on parenting to environmental changes, so that these at-risk youth have places to go that are safe and also have jobs, have a future that is hopeful for them so that they make the best decisions.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any understanding, Dr. Hargarten, of why guns are being used? Why would people be shooting at each other in playgrounds or in places where we've seen so many horrendous incidents of young people, in some cases, dying because of crossfire? Why would you feel you had to walk around with a gun, and why would you use it?
Well, that's a complex set of questions, Kathleen, that I'm not a psychologist, and knowing the inner workings of youth who are perceiving risk, they're perceiving that they're being threatened by other people in the community. Are they really well positioned to make good choices about when they go out in the evening to engage with their friends and in very healthy activities, and why the need to protect themselves? I think many youth are afraid, and they're afraid for good reasons, and they're afraid for non-existent reasons. And so one of the challenges is to remove the opportunity for them to have this product in their hands. Because once it gets into their hands, then the decision-making and interventions are a little bit late stage. And so we really would like to know more about where the firearms are coming from that land into the hands of particularly at-risk youth, so that we have less of a probability that they're going to settle a dispute or a misunderstanding with verbal exchanges as opposed to an exchange of bullets.
Mm-hmm. You were quoted shortly after the horrendous shooting at the Sikh temple where you treated victims of that massacre, which happened 2 weeks after the movie theater in Colorado and 2 days before a man pleaded guilty to killing six people and wounding 13, including Gabrielle Giffords. What I'm struggling with, you said, is this new social norm. This is what we're going to have to live with if we have more personal access to firearms. We have a public health issue to discuss. Do we wait for the next outbreak, or, and this is the part I want to ask you, is there something we can do to prevent it?
Well, it stands that is this a new norm, meaning are we pretty much accepting that inevitable outcome for the next mass shooting? I do feel that there are now training programs in place that teachers are going through and other school systems to manage the potential for this. I didn't necessarily, and I don't recall saying that increased personal access is necessarily going to result in mass shootings, but I think that unauthorized access to firearms, those who are in a good, strong, responsible position, are getting access to firearms. I think the mass shooting in Virginia Tech is a good example of a troubled youth who didn't have much difficulty obtaining firearms. So I think we need to do a better job of identifying these high-risk individuals. We have to do a better job of trying to restrict access to these high-risk individuals as best we can, so that it's less likely that these events would occur with individuals who are seeking to settle something. And it's of interest to many of us that these are largely murder suicides.
Mm-hmm.
These are largely individuals who are not seeking an outcome other than a death. And it's finding out more about these individuals and preemptively identifying them to get help for them is certainly one of the major efforts that we need to do a better job.
What about when you see these people and family members in the hospital? Is there some protocol where you give information, where you try to get to the root of this? Is there some kind of public safety message that goes when they are released, if they are still alive?
So there's a couple of things that are happening increasingly at hospitals, which, again, are limited into what they can do. But certainly projects like Project Ujima at Children's Hospital is one that was actually started in the mid-90s when several of us were discussing how when a 10-year-old comes to an emergency department with an acute case of leukemia, which sometimes happens, there's a full court healthcare response to this individual. But when a 10-year-old comes with into the emergency department with a bullet in their leg, not a similar response was present. That was the birth of Project Ujima, and that is an example of how hospitals can play a larger role in helping these individuals with this traumatic event and hopefully shape their outcomes so that they go on to lead productive lives. Adult-wise, at Frater and I think other places, but we were one of the first in the country to be screening for post-traumatic stress. You can imagine being involved in a shooting that this is very traumatic, and that researchers here at the Frater and our Injury Research Center identified that how important it was to address this early on to maximize their rehabilitation from this shooting. So there's more that healthcare systems can do, but I think there's a broader requirement for civil society to step up and really comprehensively address this, if you will, this disease burden, much like we would do other, we would pull in other public health and other leaders to address other similarly challenging healthcare problems.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Dr. Stephen Hargarten is our guest this hour. He's professor and chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin, director of the Injury Research Center. We'll continue a discussion of what we can do to prevent firearm injuries. He has done a great deal of work in the state of Wisconsin on seatbelt safety as well. So we'll ask if there is any kind of national product safety oversight of firearms. What about these cases we hear of firearms going off accidentally? There was a teacher in Utah last week, I believe, who was in the bathroom and was carrying a gun for some reason, and the gun went off and got her in the leg. So is there something that we can do that everybody can agree on to make sure that guns are as safe as they can be? One person using the gun, we'll look at that issue and others. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. Hargarten is also author of a book from 1997, Reducing Firearm Injury and Death, a public health source book on guns. It's a public health approach to gun violence. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Dr. Stephen Hargarten. Our number is 800-486-8655. Lou is our first caller in Cudahy. Hi, Lou.
I'm just curious, why would anybody in administration put up a sign that says, like in front of a school, elementary school, let's take that as an example, that says gun-free zone? You're telling every crazed maniac criminal he can come here, shoot up all kinds of people, and he may never get shot himself and be able to get away in a car. That's just patently lunacy. Don't put signs up like that. The Aurora, Colorado shooter, he bypassed two or three locations to go to a place that had a no guns welcome here sign posted. You guys, it's just breathtakingly ignorant. Why would you do that?
What do you think of those signs, Doctor?
I don't have any concrete opinion about how effective or inviting signs are like that. I don't have any data to suggest that that is somehow an invitation versus a call that the environment is seeking to have no firearms around them. I think it's interesting is that really something that does happen or not? I simply don't know. I think that there's interest. It's just interesting that how do we manage drug-free zones, gun-free zones, zones that are safe and healthy for our children? It's a great question about whether or not that's a good thing or not, and we need to know and better understand how that does become an invitation, or does that become something different?
I know you've done a great deal of work in seatbelts in the state of Wisconsin. Is a natural conversation that we have yet to have, for whatever reason, a national product safety oversight of firearms, or just an investigation as to the safety of firearms?
Well, we do know, first and foremost, there is no product safety oversight of this product in the United States. There is oversight for importing firearms that is and has been in place since 1968. It's of interest that this product's mechanical functioning really hasn't changed since the last century and even before that. And we do know that regularly firearms get dropped and they go off. Certain guns are made in such a way that if a hammer is against the firing pin and the bullet's in the chamber and the hammer is struck when it falls, the gun's going to go off. We know that. That's been not as well documented as we have mechanical failures or other failures in cars. And we don't have a system currently in place to identify the make, model of firearms that are at risk of having outcomes such as when they're dropped, they go off. So it would be a benefit to apply some of the lessons we've learned from addressing motor vehicle crashes as a public health problem to look at how we might learn from that to address firearm-related deaths and injuries, and looking at the firearm as one strategy. And it is of note that of recently, the technology of guns can change. And in fact, there is a company in Germany that has manufactured a firearm for the authorized user so that when the firearm is placed in the palm of the authorized user with the radio transponder in the wrist watch area, it's a wristwatch-like product, then the gun is able to be used. And interestingly, this was highlighted in a recent James Bond movie where James Bond was actually given this firearm as part of his, you know, technology equipment, and the bad guy took the gun away, and Mr. Bond said nicely, "Well, it's not going to work for you," and indeed it didn't. Well, that has implications. We certainly do know that guns are taken away from police officers. They are taken away. They're stolen by individuals who are intent on committing crimes. If you have this kind of product in our communities, those won't happen. You cannot take the gun away and be able to use it because you won't be having the electronic system in order for it to function. So we do think that there's opportunity to explore this in earnest and in fact look at this no differently than we've done with cars and equipping the cars with safety features such as airbags and seatbelts.
Yeah, so who needs to look at this in earnest? Who does that?
Well, I think it's, you know, individuals who want to have a firearm in their home for self-protection, as an example. Certainly, this is an opportunity for them to have a product that is then less likely to be used by a despondent teenager. And if it is indeed stolen, it's not going to be of any use. So individuals, I think, should or can have that opportunity to purchase this product. And I think that's an example. Policymakers may wish to say, hey, we would give an incentive of individuals who are purchasing this firearm for their purchase so that we have this product in place to complement or to balance off those firearms that don't have any safety features really attached to them.
And are people buying those? Do you know?
Well, currently they're not. They're available to be sold in, I believe, Maryland and other places. It's a product able to be sold. There was a backlash by individuals for being able to be selling this. A dealer in Maryland attempted to do this and was significantly coerced not to, because there is a policy in place in New Jersey that if indeed a product like this does come into the marketplace in the United States, then all firearms should have these safety features in place and within 3 years. And people are concerned about that state mandate being in place. But I think regardless of how you think about that, I think having a product that has these safety features is a good thing.
Our number is 800-486-8655. Arnold in Dodgeville. Hi.
Hi. Just a comment about the handguns being dropped in that. I'm a former law enforcement officer, retired many years ago. That was one thing we did have a problem with at that time. The new guns that handguns are coming out, many of them are hammerless, and also they've come out with a new type of hammered gun that can be let down or dropped without firing, even though there's a round in the chamber. I haven't worked with that particular gun, but the hammerless I've worked with quite a bit lately. I carry a CCW and have several guns that I've worked with. But I haven't worked with this new hammer thing, but I understand it works quite well.
That's great. I really appreciate you mentioning the newer designs. You're entirely correct. Certainly the shift from law enforcement, as I think you probably experienced, from revolvers to pistols was a major change in the culture of law enforcement, and that did have some features, safety features. If you drop it, it won't go off. And so it's the trigger pull is another issue that is certainly of a safety concern, but I think technologies are being moved along in the right direction. Unfortunately, there are many guns in circulation that don't have those safety features. That would be great to get them off the streets.
In the research that you've done, Dr. Hargarten, did you see any kind of link between consumption of alcohol, too much alcohol, and a propensity toward gun violence?
No, there's not a great deal known about that. We certainly know that arguments do take place, and arguments are unfortunately fueled by consumption of alcohol and perhaps other drugs as well. We don't know a lot about how much or indeed how much alcohol is playing out in some of these events, given that we can't or we don't get blood alcohol levels shortly after an arrest of an individual involved in an altercation or a shooting. We do know indirectly from firearm homicide suicides, domestic violence is a common scenario where the perpetrator is often a male. He shoots his intimate partner, then kills himself immediately. We do know that alcohol is on board, but it's less than half percentage points in terms of frequency. So we do know that there's some linkage, but I think it's complex to be too complex to just simply ascribe to alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Norma in Milwaukee. Hello, Norma.
Yes, hi, Kathleen. I just wanted to follow up with the smart gun that Dr. Hargarten was referring to. There was a report on the Chris Hayes show just within the last month that the NRA has really intimidated the last retailer who wanted to sell the smart gun in the U.S., so that gun is not available anywhere in the U.S. at this time, and it's really because the NRA has really intimidated the two retailers who were interested in representing the smart gun. And so I really wanted to say to the African-American community in particular, where we know that gun violence is a detrimental impact to that community and to the people in that community and young people in that community, that getting out in front of the issue of the smart gun is, I think, one thing that the community really needs to be galvanized around. It certainly isn't something that's going to help the community today, but I think we have to look at this issue in terms of the long view, that we can't just take a short view of what we can do today or tomorrow, but how can we create a society in the future where fewer guns may be in the hands of people who are too emotionally damaged to be able to use guns responsibly. Once people in that category have access and availability of guns, they're going to use them, and they're not going to use them smartly. And so to rely on them to put guns down and to use guns effectively, I think, is just missing the point. And so we really need to keep guns out of the hands of people who are too emotionally damaged to be able to use them maturely and to use them respectfully. And the smart gun would be one way in which to get at that.
Thank you, Norma. Dr. Hargan.
Well, I think the caller has some important points, and I think one of them is the short-term and the long-term view. And I think in that case, I think safety features being thoughtfully integrated into firearms, as the previous former law enforcement officer suggested, that we need to look at how we can best make this product optimally safe and reduce its accessibility to unauthorized users. I think nobody wants 14-year-olds and 17-year-olds to possess a handgun.
Yeah.
And I think a smart gun, or the technology for having this product in place so that it reduces that risk while allowing and permitting and having the opportunity for those families in which that they do wish to have a handgun in their home for protection. It's, I think, a very important element to this discussion, and I think it's very, very important that individuals do appreciate long and short-term strategies here. We hear many discussions about the significant number of guns that are out there. That is true, but we do have then a possibility for buyback programs that are focused and really wanting to get those firearms out of circulation while we have the firearms potentially in circulation that have these safety features. So this is an important civil society discussion that is measured and thoughtful so that we all agree about how we want to have our communities to be safe for all members of society.
Thank you, Norma, for your call. Lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. And we're speaking this hour about what it is we can do to prevent gun violence. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Hargarten. He's chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He is director of the Injury Research Center, and he is one of the country's foremost experts on gun violence and the public health aspect of this particular issue. Before we go back to phone calls, I was just wondering, and maybe you know this from all of your research, Dr. Hargarten, there were these series of young people, and by young, I'm talking 15, 16, 17-year-olds who were holding people up and taking cars, groups of them, and then evidently they brag about their accomplishments. Some of them were holding people at gunpoint. And I was just wondering, as I was reading it, just thinking about the audacity of what they're doing and where are their lives going, but I also wonder, where do you get guns? Are they that easily available if you're 15 years old? Where are you getting these guns?
Well, perhaps we should be more thoughtful in asking those questions in a methodical way to those very teenagers, to those very young adults, so that we look at how this product that is largely legally purchased for its first purchase. We know that mm-hmm. because an individual to buy a handgun has to go to a federal firearms dealer. The first purchase. But subsequent purchases are not required to have background checks. There is no requirement for an individual, let's say who's 22, purchases a handgun to turn around and give it to his 17-year-old cousin or to sell it to someone. So we have this challenging we have this challenge in our communities where we want to and we have a societal ruling, if you will, that permits individuals to own a firearm for protection or for hunting and so forth, and yet we have challenges about restricting this firearm from its getting into the hands of individuals that we all agree would not, nobody wants a 15-year-old to have a handgun Nobody wants a 16-year-old to be able to access a firearm when they're depressed. And how do we do that? How do we engage in thoughtful, policy-relevant discussions so that we do a better job of restricting the gun from getting into the hands? And one of the first ways is looking at the, let's say, 1,000 guns that have been confiscated from teenagers. We can do a better job of finding out where did they first come from? What was the trail? That takes resources. That takes energy of people to find out where are these kids getting the guns. But I'll bet you if you took 100 kids randomly in certain areas of the city, I bet you they can tell you where they are.
I'll bet you're right.
So I think it's something that we need to do, just like we'd want to get and understand where kids are stealing cars, where are they getting getting a hold of cars. Just like we want to find out where did this child get infected from another individual, why weren't they vaccinated? These are public health strategies that mm-hmm. we want to do a better job of employing for this particular problem.
More phone calls in a moment. And, of course, what comes to mind after hearing Dr. Hargarten say that is why it's so hard for us to have thoughtful, meaningful conversations that pretty much everybody can agree on. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hour two of our program today, we're going to talk about chimpanzees. Our guest is a doctor who worked with Jane Goodall at her famous Gombe camp back in 1972. She has found herself deeply interested in the fate of chimps ever since and went back to four African countries and found that many chimps are extinct now. We'll talk about the reasons why and the conservation efforts to keep those who are alive still alive. Plus, she just has wonderful stories about the empathy and the relationships that she's built with chimps in Africa. That's coming up hour two. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls. Joshua in Madison, hi.
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 There was a few comments by people associated with the smart gun, and the first smart gun was actually introduced in around 1987, where it used an encoding or some kind of a code. The reason it keeps getting shot down is not just because of NRA legislation, but also the lack of interest by consumers of those products. And the thing that kind of gets me, I left my career as a gunsmith and firearms instructor because of the level of violence associated with it and, I guess, the mentality of the people surrounding it. But when sexual abuse or domestic violence happens, we try to force or impose education upon people in order to prevent these things. And seeing throughout the years what education can do for firearms, I believe maybe firearms instruction or just the knowledge of how dangerous it is and what a responsibility it is could be of great importance to preventing some of these accidents or uses in suicide or domestic violence or things of that nature. It doesn't have to be, even an option for these people if they are educated upon it.
You don't think we're doing education at all now or just a little bit, not enough? What do you think, Josh?
I received my first rifle when I was six, and I shot my first handgun at eight.
Oh, my gosh.
I grew up in a culture of firearms. It wasn't abnormal to have a firearm. And certain many, many places, it's not uncommon at all for a child of 10 years old to receive a rifle for Christmas. It's not a frightening thing. It is the tool, and it is dangerous, just like giving a 16-year-old a car. Can definitely kill if you don't pay attention and follow safety rules. I don't think we have the education. I used to bring my rifle to school for hunting season. That is definitely not allowed today. Most high schools and grade schools used to have shooting ranges in them throughout the country. It just it became a taboo thing. And I think the more we make something unobtainable or taboo, it becomes more appealing to people who probably shouldn't have them in the first place.
I'm not sure any 8 or 10-year-old should have them, but people may disagree. Dr. Hargarden.
Well, it's interesting. He brought up, the caller brought up a couple of very important points. First of all, yes, he's right. The smart gun thinking, the technologies that have been applied over the years. Actually, I is part of my public speaking and education. I've got several firearms that I use to illustrate safety features, and one of them is a Fox carbine was actually manufactured in 1974, where the manufacturer put a combination lock literally in the into the firearm. So firearm manufacturers have been thinking about this for many years, and they've been thinking about this actually since the 1880s.
Whoa.
Where there was a grip safety applied to a Smith & Wesson handgun to reduce children from accessing it. So this is not new to think about technologies and the firearm, and I think that that's an important point that the caller makes, is that this is not new, as his he made reference to the 1980s, and it's been before that too. The second area that he brings up is education. I agree that education is extremely important, but I think education has its limits. I don't think, and I agree with the caller, you make a product taboo, and then you suddenly make it now much more intriguing to inquiring adolescents or individuals who want to or who are intent on doing harm. So education is certainly a partner in this. I think technologies is also a partner, if not an equal partner to education, and certainly environmental strategies to reduce individuals from harming well-lit streets, as an example, well-lit alleys to defer mischief. All these things can be brought to bear that complement strong educational approaches.
Thank you, Joshua. Amy in Lone Creek, hi, or Lone Rock. Hi.
Hello there.
Hi.
So my question is, somebody earlier said something about how getting older, more unsafe guns off the street could happen. And I'm just wondering how that happens. Do you offer somebody a reward to bring in their older, more unsafe gun, or do you offer them something else? That was my question.
All right.
Sure. There's certainly buyback programs have been across the country. In many ways, that's nobody's really looked at how effective that would be. We had a gun buyback program here in Milwaukee several years ago that resulted in firearms being returned that were revolvers that were with manufacturers that had been out of business for 15 years. So it struck us that the buyback programs were not focused and targeted to reduce the prevalence of high-risk guns that we know are associated with homicides and suicides, such as 9mm pistols, 38 caliber pistols, and so forth. In terms of this being now fast-forwarding to trying to balance having firearms that, let's say, are in circulation that have technologies integrated into the firearm that is for the authorized user only, then a buyback program, at least I was conjecturing that, then a focused buyback program would be to then try to get the firearms that are in circulation that can be used by anybody, including unauthorized individuals, to get those firearms out of the community so that the firearms that are in circulation are those that have the safety features that reduce unauthorized usage. It reduces the fact that a criminal who steals a gun can use it. It reduces the likelihood that a despondent adolescent can use it, and it thus achieves a safety feature collectively like we've achieved with cars with airbags. We are now achieving injury prevention with cars that are technologically changed from the way they were 30 years ago. And I might add, airbags were invented in the 1950s. They weren't integrated fully into cars until the 1980s when the manufacturers started to embrace this technology. It seems that we have an opportunity to parallel that with firearms that are have safety features integrated into their design.
Well, I'm still trying to figure out, Dr. Hargarten, why we don't make progress on this. And you, of all people, I mean, you're an emergency room physician. You've been treating people who are victims of firearm violence, horrendous acts of violence. You've done all this public health research with statistics, et cetera, and you speak in a measured, informed, calm fashion. Why is it that you wouldn't be prominently at the head of a table of people, and I have to believe it's 90 at least, if not more, percent of Americans, who really would like to hear what you have to say and then institute those kinds of changes so there won't be as much firearm violence? It just seems sort of common sense to me, and yet it doesn't seem to happen, and I don't quite understand that.
Well, I think that we could, certainly many others could also discuss this for a lot longer than your hour program permits. We have and one of the callers made reference to a culture. I think one of the culture that we have is tends to have an individualistic approach to in many ways, that societal issues are individually solved versus collectively solved. We, I think, can do a better job of bringing leaders of civil society together. And I think we don't do a good enough job of listening to all sides, listening to everyone's concerns, so that we collectively begin to develop the policies, evaluate the policies. Does it work? Does it not work? I think those discussions don't occur, and we would hope that they would, with policymakers in Madison, with leaders of civil society that every community has, that we would do a better job of sitting down and really thoughtfully advancing our understanding, placing resources so if we don't understand something, we can better understand it. And then we have resources such as the Wisconsin Violent Death Reporting System that you made reference to, how we did this early on in the 90s. We then can evaluate whether or not a policy did make any difference. Right. And if so, what was the scope and nature of that difference? Or maybe it didn't make any difference. And again, another caller said short-term and long-term. We're too focused on short-term solutions and really not focusing on the long-term investments required to make a difference.
Yeah. Jesus in Walworth, getting short on time, everyone. Hi, Jesus.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Yeah, good. Can you speak up? You're a little...
Say that again?
I just need to have you speak up. You're a little distant.
Yes. Well, I have to say one thing about gun control. It does not work. What works is gun education. There's always going to be people that want to diminish gun power for whatever reason it is. The main thing is that at the end of all things, we still need ways to defend ourselves and our liberties and many other things there. It will take too long in your program. But let me tell you, I already went once through one of these things. It was in Mexico. And it doesn't work. It didn't work. People have been kidnapped. I was kidnapped. Okay, so gun control does not work because at the end of all things, bad people always get their hand on a gun.
Dr. Hargarten.
Yeah, I didn't really hear everything that the caller mentioned, but I did think I heard about the fact that the only solution is education, and I would really respectfully disagree that. I think, again, as I've said, education is important, but I don't think it's the only answer. I think the concerns that if a bad guy wants to get a gun, they're going to get it. I think that is a short-term challenge that's probably not going to go away anytime soon. But I think, again, to the caller's long-term strategy, I think we do and can do a better job of seeing how we best can reduce access to this product to unauthorized individuals, to individuals who are intent in committing a bad act, to kidnap someone, to rob somebody, and to rape somebody. So these are a thorny issue. And I, again, also want to remind the callers and the listeners is that I have not mentioned gun control once. This is it's a poorly defined subject matter. My interest is in injury prevention and control. I'm not interested in taking away firearms from anybody. I'm interested in seeing fewer firearm deaths and injuries in our community.
Dr. Hargarten, thank you so much for being with us. It was a great hour. Thanks.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Dr. Stephen Hargarten, professor and chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He directs the Injury Research Center, and he has treated a number of victims of firearm violence at Frederick Hospital. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour and to KP as well for on-air production. Just a reminder, tomorrow the author of the Roosevelt's piece, the companion to the documentary, which is on PBS this week. Stay tuned. We talk about chimps, hour two of our Tuesday program.